Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and culture stories. I am Netta Ulibi. As a reminder, you can, as always, subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, a look at the new film Black Swan and the history of dancers descending into madness on screen. The winner of Billboard's Rising Star Award for Women in Music, Jasmine Sullivan, discusses her new album. And the supervillainous plot to finish off James Bond. But first,
if you're a fan of The Daily Show, then you're probably familiar with regular correspondent Asif Mandvi.
Well, John, if they're not going to make a distinction between Muslims and violent extremists, then why should I take the time to distinguish between decent, fearful white people and racists?
Okay.
Before Asif Mandvi was a comedian, however, he was an actor in movies and on stage. His latest film is called Today's Special. It's inspired by a one-person play he wrote. He plays Samir, a high-class chef who takes over his father's rundown Indian restaurant after his dad has a heart attack. Asif Mandvi visited our New York bureau this week, and he told me the film is about more than just food.
The journey of Samir, our hero, is the journey from his disassociation with his culture to the reclaiming of his culture. He wants to be a great chef, but he's never going to be the great chef that he wants to be until he actually reclaims his identity that he has let go. And food represents one's home, one's culture, one's family. And so, you know, immigrant communities always hold on to their food and their language. Those are the two things they tend to hold on to in order to retain their immigrant identity.
This is also about, I guess, multi-generational families. And talk about, I guess, your own family in this respect, because I read that you were actually born in India, raised in England, and now your family is based in Tampa, Florida.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I took a lot of stuff from my own family. I took a lot of stuff that my dad says and my mom says. There's one line that I love in the movie where Samir's father tells him, do whatever you want with your life.
Go to France, go to England. Huh?
Go into England, France, China.
Marry a bloody Chinese clown girl.
Marry a Chinese clown girl and have your mother come and cry at the bloody wedding, you know? And that's really something my dad has said, you know? My dad has used the term Chinese clown girl. And so, marry a Chinese clown girl.
Now, in the film, Samir's father doesn't really hide his disappointment in his son's choice of career, being a chef.
Right.
What did your own parents say when you told them you wanted to be an actor?
You know, they weren't thrilled about it, you know. I mean, as any reasonable parent, they sort of tried to talk me out of it. But, you know, we sort of migrated to America when I was in high school, and I started taking theater and drama and stuff. And I think that what happened in my life was that my parents were so busy trying to start this new life in America that I ended up taking all these drama classes. And so it sort of just snowballed. And before my parents had realized, they turned around and I was already, doing theater. And it was like a passion and a love in my life. And so, you know, theater and acting have always been with me since then.
The plays I've read that you've done, especially some of your work in New York a few years ago, tackle some very serious topics. I mean, you were in a play a few years back called Guantanamo, which is about, I think, a Muslim detainee at that prison base.
And yeah.
Another one called Homebody Kabul. Was it a conscious thing? Because I know for many actors in Hollywood and in theater that when you are brown, you get typecast into all kinds of roles. So why this focus on identity, and how did that play out in the other aspects of your career?
A lot of my own writing and my own work has ultimately had to do with identity and East versus West, and what Tony Kushner loves to call the Greco-Bactrian confusion. And after 9/11, of course, it became even more heightened for me, because being raised as a Muslim and living in the West, it suddenly became very personal.
And I think it's interesting that, you know, you're getting these roles at a time also where there's probably a lot of roles around for people to play the terrorist.
Right.
And I
get offered those, you know, and I audition for those. And the thing is, it's always for me really about the role. I mean, I've never said, oh, I don't want to play a terrorist, you know. But it is really about the dimensions of the role and the complexity and you know, because I mean, it's very easy for people to sort of just write one-dimensional roles in any capacity. I mean, I started off my career playing one-dimensional cab drivers and deli owners, you know, and then it became one-dimensional terrorists and doctors. But if the role has complexity to it, then I think it is it's worth exploring, you know.
That's actor Asif Manvi. He can be seen as a correspondent on The Daily Show and in his new film, Today's Special, which is currently in limited release in theaters across the country. Asif Manvi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
This Thanksgiving should have featured the premiere of the 23rd James Bond film, but it never got made. MGM, which owns the rights to the franchise, is in bankruptcy. A restructured studio should emerge in 2 weeks, but they haven't figured out how they're going to pay for a new 007 film. NPR's Robert Smith assembled a meeting of the world's greatest supervillains to see if they have finally defeated James Bond.
I see you finally regained consciousness, Mr. Bond. Look around you. I've brought in all your friends to watch your demise. Auric Goldfinger?
You have interfered with my plans for the last time, Mr. Bond.
Dr. No?
There's so much to discuss, so little time.
And of course, the head of Spectre.
I am Ernst Stavro Blofeld. They told me you were assassinated in Hong Kong.
Yes, this is my second life.
You only live twice, Mr. Bond.
Too bad your movie studio, MGM, can't say the same thing. They have no more money for aging super spies, Mr. Bond. That's why we've suspended you above this cage. Do you recognize your studio's famous mascot, the MGM Lion? He works for us now. And in a few moments, he will be digesting you.
Do you expect me to talk? No, Mr. Bond, I expect you to die.
But first, don't you think that Mr. Bond deserves a gratuitous explanation of how the greatest movie studio in history, MGM, was pushed over the cliff? I even brought in a reporter to help write the obituary.
I'm Matthew Garahan, and I cover Hollywood for the Financial Times.
Mr. Garahan, remind us what it was like in Hollywood during the boom years of the economy.
Markets were awash with money. Raising money to buy companies was easy. Credit was freely available.
MGM was bought and sold over and over, the last time for $5 billion. Most of it was borrowed money and hedge fund hocus pocus. They wanted you, Mr. Bond. Or more accurately, MGM's vast library of old movies.
In the MGM library, they have RoboCop, When Harry Met Sally, Silence of the Lambs, another big hit from the 80s.
Those investors thought that people would buy classic DVDs forever.
And those habits seem to have changed. People have run out of space on their shelves. They don't buy DVDs in the way that they used to.
In your final moments, Mr. Bond, I want you to think about that. The great 007 was killed by a lack of shelf space. It seems like a small thing, but it was crucial. Those DVD sales used to generate hundreds of millions of dollars a year. When the money started to disappear, MGM couldn't finance another Bond film. And since it couldn't finance new films, the library became less and less attractive. The studio was paralyzed by its $4 billion debt. Oh, yes. And then Spectre engineered a global financial collapse.
And the value of your gold increases many times. Brilliant.
It's so brilliant, we're not even going to watch the lion eat you, Mr. Bond. We're going to retire to the next room for a glass of brandy. Gentlemen, a toast to the death of... What is it? MGM's emerging from bankruptcy? They made a deal with their creditors? Get me Edward J. Epstein. He wrote the book The Hollywood Economist.
All the debt is wiped out. MGM has zero debt now. Because the people who it owed money to got stock instead. Will they succeed? Probably. They'll probably get another James Bond movie.
But Bond is dead.
It was in all the newspapers.
Rubbish. Bond is alive. This organization does not tolerate failure.
I know, but you see, I...
Go.
No, wait. There is one last chance to kill James Bond. Let them make the very expensive film.
If it doesn't click with the youth audience, the franchise is dead. MGM is dead, and so is James Bond. They die or live together, which could be the title for the next James Bond movie.
Wherever you are, Mr. Bond, I hope you enjoy your usual post-escape frolic.
Oh, James.
It will be your last. Now all I need is a new alias. How about Robert Smith, NPR News.
This week, singer-songwriter Jasmine Sullivan will receive Billboard's Rising Star Award for Women in Music. It's just one of the many awards and accolades she's garnered in her blazing rise to the top. In 2008, her debut album, Fearless, snagged 5 Grammy nominations, and her singles secured long-standing slots at the top of the hip-hop and R&B charts. Sullivan also releases her second album this week. It's called Love Me Back, and Jasmine Sullivan joins us from member station WHYY in her hometown of Philadelphia. Welcome to the program, Jasmine.
Thank you. That was a good introduction.
I
feel like I want to take you everywhere now.
Well, it's kind of hard to fit your career into, you know, 3 paragraphs, but we tried anyway.
That was great. Thank you.
Yeah. The first single from your new album is called Holding You Down. We want to listen to just a little bit of it. Does a lot of your music come from personal experience?
Yes, it does. As I look at, you know, all the songs that I've written, I see now that some of them have been a little too personal. I think line for line, some of them. But yeah, it's very therapeutic for me at times to sit down and just write lyrics and write music.
I want to hearken back to a tune that came off your previous album, Fearless, Bust Your Windows. Is that telling us a little bit too much about yourself?
Yeah, it is.
I bust the windows out your car, and though it didn't mend my broken heart, I'll probably always have these ugly scars, but right now I don't care about that part.
Yeah, that was actually one of the first songs that I did write about, line for line, really, what happened. And I started to use my gift of writing in that way. And, you know, it was a really, really hard time. But it's helped a lot of people and a lot of women, I feel, who are going through the same thing that I've went through. Or, you know, it just helps.
It empowers them just a little bit. There's another song in this album. This is a duet with your friend Neo. It sounds a lot like your normal R&B love ballad, but then when you listen to it, it's really not.
Yeah.
we'll hear a little bit of it. I love it. You get on my nerves. That is not a love song.
No, it's not. And actually, Neo came up, you know, with the title and everything for the song. And I was asking him, was he trying to tell me something? Was he saying something personal to me? But it was a lot of fun, you know, working with another writer and another artist. That was the first time I had worked with anybody like that. So I had a lot of fun. We were feeding off of each other and, you know, it was cool.
Philadelphia has long been an incubator for rhythm and blues and music. And how would you say your hometown, Philly, is reflected in your sound?
Oh, I mean, it's very much reflected in it. I grew up in the Philly scene. I was about 13 or 14 singing in the Black Lily when I was younger. And I ran across musical greats like Jill and the Roots and Flowetry and Jaguar Wright and Jazzy Fat Nasties and Kendrick. And that's where I gained the love for music and for soul music. And I incorporate it with the things that I have learned past then with my music now.
Yeah. I do have to ask you about, it's a really unforgettable track because it's so different from what's on the rest of the album, Redemption.
Yeah.
Describe what's going on in this song.
Oh, man. Redemption, it's a story of two different people, a man and a woman who have led these lives, these hard lives, really, and they finally get to a point where their lives are on the line. And they are asking for forgiveness and for redemption to God, you know, and really, you know, praying to him to help them through their situation. And it's a very passionate song, and it's very deep and sad almost.
Very dark.
Yeah. And the track was that way, and the track kind of led me to write the story. I love writing stories. I've been in plays since I was younger. My mom wrote plays, and that was always it's one thing that I liked, and I'm able to actually write stories, so the track actually spoke to me and made me write the story.
Yeah, you were quoted as saying you really weren't in control. You were just being given words to create the story.
Yeah, honestly, because I really didn't have an idea of what I wanted to write about with that song. I started actually just writing line by line, and the story started to unfold and present itself to me. So it was a gift, really, that I, you know, got to see it.
Jasmine Sullivan's new album is called Love Me Back on the J Records label. It comes out Tuesday. Jasmine Sullivan spoke to us from member station WHYY in Philadelphia. Thanks so much. And
thank you so
good
much.
Luck.
Thank you.
Nobody ever loved me. You love it like a good dude, and he loved me a lot. And no other man is gonna take his spot. And I am so happy you're mine. So I'ma love you a long time.
Director Darren Aronofsky's film, Black Swan, is a new take on an old theme, a ballerina whose quest for artistic excellence drives her crazy. Alex Cohen of member station KPCC in Pasadena reports that madness and ballet have often come together in a cinematic pas de deux.
In Black Swan, Natalie Portman plays a ballerina, so obsessed with her craft, the actress says she's what's known in the dance world as a bunhead.
They are sort of reputed to live and die ballet. They won't go out on a Friday or Saturday night and drink. They're not going to eat very much. They're not going to let loose.
Portman's character Nina pleads with the New York City Ballet's artistic director for the leading role in Swan Lake, but he's not convinced she's up to the task.
Every time you dance, I see you obsessed, getting each and every move perfectly right, but I never see you lose yourself. All that discipline for what?
Want to be perfect.
You what?
Want to be perfect.
Nina manages to be perfect enough to land the part. She's graceful and innocent, but like many other celluloid ballerinas, she's unable to tap into the darker, sensual side of dance. Meanwhile, a rival dancer in the company who can threatens to steal the role of the Swan Princess away from Nina. The pressure eventually leads to a disturbing mental breakdown, where Nina herself seems to become half woman, half swan. Throughout Black Swan, Nina literally tears away at her own skin.
I just thought it was an interesting contrast to take something as beautiful as ballet and then add horror to it.
Director Darren Aronofsky.
But then I realized it wasn't that much different than actual ballets. And if you look at the great stories of the ballet, Swan Lake, Sleeping Beauty, Romeo and Juliet, they're tragic, they're gothic, they're, you know, have horrific elements.
Though Black Swan may be the most extreme case, it's one in a long list of films to cast dark and ugly shadows on one of the most beautiful art forms.
Why do you want to dance?
Why do you want to live?
I don't know exactly why, but I must.
That's my answer, too.
In 1948, The Red Shoes told the story of a ballerina named Vicky who gets her big break after appearing in Swan Lake. Film critic David Ehrenstein wrote the liner notes for the DVD re-release of The Red Shoes. He explains that Vicky's madness stems from a difficult choice.
In becoming a star, she then also falls in love with a young composer, and she is then stuck between her love for the composer and her love for the world of ballet.
In Vicky's case, the stress eventually drives her to jump in front of a train. Things work out a bit better for Shirley MacLaine and Anne Bancroft in the 1977 film The Turning Point. The two portray middle-aged ballet dancers whose lives seem incomplete. One because she left ballet to raise a family, the other seems to have nothing but an existence in pointe shoes.
You don't remember when Michael was choreographing Anna Karenina?
Yes, of course I do.
And who was he rehearsing for the part of Anna?
You and me.
And?
You got pregnant.
Yeah. And you got 19 curtain calls.
In most ballet films, that choice between dance and domesticity is just one of many elements causing emotional and physical pain. In fact, there are so many common elements in these movies, you could easily base a drinking game on them. You'd be chugging for each close-up of a blistered foot, scenes depicting endless hours of grueling rehearsals, and injuries that can end a dancer's career in an instant. There's also the overbearing stage mothers, like the one in the film Center Stage about students at a ballet academy in New York.
I don't want to be a ballet dancer.
Yes, you do. You always have.
No, Mom. If this were what I wanted, I wouldn't be as unhappy as I've been. And I'd have friends. I'd sleep well. I wouldn't throw up half the things that I eat.
You watch your weight. There's nothing wrong with that.
God, don't you hear me? I'm telling you, I'm unhappy and sick. I can't do this anymore. Don't you care about this?
Of course I care, of course. But this is your dream. Maureen, don't just throw away your dream.
Dreams of young ballerinas in film often become nightmares because of the emotional duress caused by stern instructors and demanding impresarios. In Robert Altman's The Company, actor Malcolm McDowell plays a role based on the artistic director of the Joffrey Ballet.
What happened? I mean, you're all so pretty. You know how I hate pretty. Now, come on. I mean, lift thighs. Lift up. Not so loady. You're looking like you've got a load in your pants.
The depiction of the teachers and the directors in the films are very grim, aren't they? They're just horrible people. And we're not.
Susan Pillar danced with the real New York City Ballet for 16 years and now teaches at the School of American Ballet. She says ballet films tend to go overboard. The dancers have a lot more fun in real life than they do on the silver screen. But she says it's easy to understand why movie directors present ballet this way.
Real ballet life is not going to make a great movie because it's not dramatic enough.
But film critic David Ehrenstein disagrees. Just look, he says, at all the sacrifice required to become a great ballerina. Most begin their training when they're just a few years old.
And your career is very short. A dancer's career only lasts as long as a dancer's body is able to do the work. That's great dramatic material.
Which is why director Darren Aronofsky chose ballet as the focus of his film, Black Swan. Originally, he says, the screenplay revolved around two actresses competing with each other off-Broadway. But he says the world of ballet provided a much better canvas for his psychological thriller. Though tutus and terror may not seem like a good combination at first glance, the director says the mix is working well with early audiences, especially since so many American moviegoers have a penchant for horror.
The thing that's been most interesting is getting these guys who come in who have no interest in ballet and dance and hear them say, oh, the ballet sequences were so beautiful. So getting that beauty next to the pain and the blood and the angst, it will hopefully give people something different to see that they've never seen before.
And Aronofsky says that thrill may just motivate moviegoers who've never seen a ballet performance in their lives to check out the real thing. For NPR News, I'm Alex Cohen.
Our series 50 Great Voices continues now with a singer whose voice is often described as flawless and smooth as silk.
Love has truly been good to me. Not even one sad day or minute have I had since you've come my way.
The late Luther Vandross wasn't just known for romantic music. NPR's Elizabeth Blair says he was the go-to singer for anyone looking to get in the mood.
We'll get to the bedroom in a moment. First, the voice.
I can't feel myself. I don't want nobody else to ever love me.
Supremely fine-tuned, controlled, and yet effortless.
There's not a minute, hour, day, or night that I don't love you. You're at the top of my list 'cause I'm always thinking of you.
Luther Vandross knew so much about singing. Before he went solo in the early 1980s, he was a backup vocalist in high demand. Bette Midler, David Bowie, Barbara Streisand, these are just a few of the stars who wanted to work with him. He first met bass player Marcus Miller when they were both in Roberta Flack's band.
Luther was amazing. He was a connoisseur of background singers.
Marcus Miller was one of the most in-demand session musicians at the time, so he and Luther Vandross were almost always bumping into each other.
I was probably 17, 18 years old when I met him, and I was a hardcore musician, mostly jazz, so I didn't really respect singers that much. They were just somebody in the front of the band to entertain the audience while we were doing the real work in the back, you know?
But Marcus Miller says Luther Vandross changed his mind.
Because we're on the road, you know, and you know, during the downtime when we weren't performing, Luther would, you know, he would educate me. He'd play me, you know, Aretha Franklin. He'd play me Donny Hathaway. He'd play me the great, great singers and explain to me exactly what they were doing. Most singers can't do that because, you know, although they're very talented, they're not really kind of technically knowledgeable about what they're doing. But Luther was. So he'd say to me, listen to Dion. She's going to hold back the vibrato. She's going to add it right now for drama. You know what I mean? He would hit me like that. And I was like, whoa, this is like playing an instrument. This is, you know, this is pretty incredible here. And I became a fan of singing, and I became a fan of Luther.
And Marcus Miller worked with him for decades and became one of his closest collaborators when Luther Vandross went solo.
Here and now, I promise to love faithfully.
Before long, some of the singers who Luther Vandross idolized growing up became fans of his, like Dionne Warwick.
I've always described Luther's voice as a piece of velvet. It was smooth to the touch, easy to feel, wonderful to look at. When I heard Luther's voice, I heard peace. It made me feel good.
And what sort of mood could Luther Vandross put you in?
Oh, see, I had to censor myself right then when you you asked me that question. I'll just say baby-making mood. How about that?
Stephanie Williams is music director for the nationally syndicated Tom Joyner Morning Show. So she picks songs that will appeal to the radio show's older audience. She says it's a funny thing with Luther Vandross. Even though he could make just about anybody think about things to do in the bedroom, Williams says he was not the object of desire.
It wasn't a sex symbol thing with Luther, even though his music was extremely sexy, you know. He could get us in the mood to be with this other guy. And we love that. Dum, 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 dum. Hey, yeah, baby.
Whoa, honey. You can see just how much women adored Luther Vandross in a video of the NAACP Image Awards in 1988 when he sang A House Is Not a Home to an ecstatic audience. Anita Baker is almost giddy. A young Janet Jackson has a huge smile on her face. And Dionne Warwick, who originally made the song famous, is beaming as Luther sings what she calls the definitive version.
And a house is not a home when there. To hold you tight and no one there that you can kiss good night. Good morning, good evening, good afternoon, hello, bye-bye, baby. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Marcus Miller says he saw firsthand how Luther Vandross didn't need any masculine swagger to make women swoon.
He did it like the opposite. You know, he did it with like sensitivity, you know, just being honest and being open with your emotions. I think that really gets to women. I'll tell you, man, he got more underwear thrown at him, man, than a little bit.
Luther Vandross apparently never liked having underwear thrown at him on stage or the nickname King of the Bedroom. Marcus Miller says Vandross believed he sang about something deeper.
To him, love was the ultimate. Two people just being connected like on that special level. I think that was the ultimate to him.
But Miller says Luther Vandross never really found it himself.
I didn't meet anybody who was like steady with him. You know, it worked out for a while, but then, you know, I don't know, man. I think that's what made his song so intense, is that he was looking for that. The one thing that he loved so much and he sang so well about is the one thing that he really didn't get himself.
Are you gonna be in love with me? I want you and need you to be, yeah, still in love with me.
Luther Vandross died July 1st, 2005. On a DVD special called Always and Forever, the man who started his career as the backup singer and arranger everybody wanted in their band was thrilled to say he'd come into his own.
One thing that I love about what's happened in my career is that I was never heralded as the new Otis Redding, the new Sam Cooke, the new Teddy Pendergrass, or Smokey Robinson. I wasn't the new anybody. I was Luther.
Dionne Warwick says many have tried to be the new Luther, but in her mind, no one has come close. Elizabeth Blair, NPR News.
Still in love with me. Are you gonna be?
You can hear the music of Luther Vandross and discover more from our 50 Great Voices series at nprmusic.org.
Still in love with me. Yeah.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's arts channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulaby. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.